The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by the 9th of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello, and welcome to the Spectator's Coffeehouse Shots podcast. Today, I'm joined by Katie Balls and I'm James Forsyth. Now, Katie, we are both down in London, but that's not where the action is today. The action today is up in Yorkshire in the Batley and Spen by-election. Now, I think it is fair to say that the Westminster consensus view is that Labour are likely to suffer a defeat there. And there is some pre-positioning going on in the New Statesman this week. Andy Burnham is profiled, talking about when in the circumstances under which he might return to Westminster. And the Times today carries a story about Angela Rayner readying herself if Keir Starmer were to run into further problems. What do you think is going on in Labour right now, and how weak is Keir Starmer's position?
I think it's interesting because, as you say, there is this feeling, not just, I think, in the lobby, but among Labour MPs, that tomorrow is not going to be an easy day. It's going to be another difficult day for Keir Starmer's leadership, and it is most likely a loss. I think the fact that, I think, as we've previously touched on, Tory MPs were so happy and so keen to say the words Batley and Spen in Prime Minister's questions tells you that the Tory party is feeling increasingly confident about this as a win. Now, there could always be a surprise, but I think if you take as the most likely scenario this sense, or at least this expectation, that it's going to be a miserable result for Labour, then I think you start to get into questions of Keir's leadership. And I think there are two things here. So I think what's been interesting is in the build-up to this by-election, we have seen changes to Keir Starmer's top team. And when we say changes, more departures than appointments, which I personally think was a politically risky thing to do, because we have a situation where you have his director of communications, very loyal to him. You have Jane Chapman, his political secretary, very loyal to him, being moved away. And some of that's through choice. I think you look at the various things, you know, but the outside picture is people being moved away from senior positions where they're incredibly loyal to the leader. And you have people like Deborah Mattison coming in. But I think when we're reading and we're hearing reports that there could be a leadership challenge from people like Angela Rayner, which is being battered down by Angela Rayner, it's worth pointing out, you can't help but wonder, well, were that to happen, who are Keir Starmer's people who are going to step in and actually, you know, come to bat for him? And I do think that's a problem he's facing. But are we heading to one? I think it clearly had to take everything with a pinch of salt in terms of denials from politicians. Now, Angela Rayner has said she does not recognise the story on the front of the Times today, which suggests that her people are getting ready to move should it be a disastrous loss for Labour tomorrow. I think that, you know, things can still happen. And it's also been reported in The Sun previously that, you know, allies of Angela Rayner were asking around. I think what is certainly the case is that ever since the Hartlepool by-election loss, those local election results, when Keir Starmer attempted to reshuffle his top team and it was a botched reshuffle, there's been a lot of discontent in the shadow cabinet, and it's put Keir Starmer in a vulnerable position. Doesn't mean he's going anywhere, but it does mean people who should have his back don't necessarily have his back.
It is remarkable, isn't it, that this by-election is of Labour's creation. It is that they, Tracy Brabin, the sitting MP, or the previous MP for Batley and Spen, ran for a mayoral job, which also involves police and crime commission responsibilities, and that means she has to step down. When you consider all the trouble that this is causing the Labour Party, it is remarkable that they could have avoided this by simply saying to Tracy Brabin, who is not, he's not going to form a cabinet minister who's uncontrollable, you know, look, please don't do this. I mean, it is incredible. It strikes me that Keir Starmer at the moment reminds me rather of Theresa May in after the 2017 election, which is, even if there is not a leadership challenge, there is just very little discipline among his shadow cabinet. People are happy to say, to speak and talk, and the leader is almost a peripheral figure. This debate about the party's future is going on around them. Now, as you say, things can change, and Keir Starmer did turn in, I think, probably his best parliamentary performance as Labour leader yesterday. But how does he regain that authority, or is that never coming back?
Yeah, I was also thinking about that Theresa May comparison recently, because you have someone who, in a way, everyone's a bit too scared to move. Perhaps not everyone will see soon. But, you know, people are scared to move in terms of what happens if you do. So they stay in place so the party can just soldier on. But yet, at the same time, authority is slowly draining from them. The fact they cannot move the top team in the way they wanted to. Obviously, Labour sources say, oh, the reshuffle went exactly as we planned. It clearly didn't. And you have a situation where Angela Rayner, who's obviously been talked up as this leadership rival, may not be that, but she is someone who has more authority as a result of the botched reshuffle, rather than less, whereas Keir Starmer has less. And I think that, I suppose, looking ahead, I think what Keir Starmer does need to do quite quickly to shore up his position is bring in these new appointments. He's got an interim director of communications. He's got Deborah Mathieson joining. But what Labour MPs are saying who don't want to see him go but are very depressed by the whole situation is, what is the strategy? And I think at the moment there just is not that clear sense of this. I think when it comes to his own position, I think one of the other parallels of Theresa May is there are plenty of Labour MPs who are very worried about what replaces Keir Starmer. It doesn't mean that it is, that they think Keir Starmer is good or able or the right person, but they worry, if you look at what happened to Jeremy Corbyn, that were you to start a leadership contest, which the parliamentary party get to decide if it starts, and then goes to the membership, things can really go somewhere else. And I've had Labour MPs say to me that they think there's a chance Richard Bergen might win it at that point. And if you remember him from the Jeremy Corbyn shadow cabinet, which just gives you, I think, a bit of insight into the scenarios playing over people's minds when they're thinking about what is a miserable outlook. Though, of course, that there are by-election surprises, so...
No. Look, and I think also the nature of it for Labour is that expectations are so low that if they were to hold in balance spend by whatever margin, Keir Starmer could kind of declare that the fight back starts here. Now, one of the things that is causing Labour all of its problems is the way in which kind of Brexit drove into its coalition. You know, it has caused this realignment in British politics. Now, today's news, I mean, that Nissan are building this new investment in their Sunderland plant, obviously has a kind of certain iconic status because of Sunderland's decision to vote to leave, and also the battery factory that is going on there. What do you think this says about Brexit and the future of the car industry?
I think it's interesting, partly because we know that electric vehicles are something the government really views as important in terms of their net zero target, in terms of the target by which they hope to ban the sale of petrol cars. But there are big problems at the moment when you think about the price of electric cars. So obviously in all these polls, lots of enthusiasm for the green agenda. But when you actually whittle it down and you get to, oh, well, how would you feel if someone told you you had to get rid of your boiler? How would you feel if someone told you had to give up your car and buy an electric car at current prices? It tends to go a little bit more pear-shaped. So I think big investment shows how the UK could start to tackle that. And then I think also just, we did hear lots of these doomsday warnings back during the EU referendum about car manufacturing going away from here because of these supply chains. I think the investment today, or the level of it, suggests that we're heading to a couple of companies going bigger here in hopes of capturing the UK market. What do you make of it, James?
Yeah, I think you're right that Nissan's strategic aim is to take a much larger share of the UK market. I mean, this battery factory is important because if you don't have the batteries by in a few years' time, it wouldn't qualify for tariff-free export to Europe because of that factor. I think the government will be very relieved about this Nissan investment, because this Nissan plant has become one of the kind of iconic Brexit things. It was kind of frequently said thing after the 2016 referendum, you know, which is, oh my word, these people in Sunderland voted for Brexit, and it's going to lead to this Nissan plant, which has transformed Sunderland's economic fortunes, being shut down because that is so dependent on the single market. That I think is clearly not going to happen, because Nissan have decided to kind of double down on the UK. But I think you can't say from this, oh, this means the entire UK motor industry is going to be fine. I think there's a kind of a question about the shift to electric and how that changes the kind of whole global motor trade, really, which I think is interesting. I was very struck this morning how Kwasi Kwarteng, the business secretary, is up in Sunderland, and he said that, you know, he was explicit about Brexit. He said, look, the faith that voters showed in their country when they voted to leave has been vindicated by today's news. So I mean, the government are kind of trying to say that this is a benefit of Brexit directly.
And finally, James, one of the things that's been leading the news this week when it comes to COVID is what's happening in schools. There's a lot of anger at the moment about the fact that so many pupils are having to self-isolate, the bubble system. You have the government now suggesting, oh, these schools are actually being overzealous when they're applying the rules they've been given, which seems a little bit shady. And then you also have Gavin Williams saying that he wants to scrap the system for a new system, which would, at the moment, it seems, involve more testing, not less. Now, I think this is interesting because when you have these debates playing out in public, a lot of people will say, well, the answer to this surely is to vaccinate children. But we've had a bit of an update on that today, haven't we? Those who are involved in terms of the medical body into child vaccination say that a cautious approach is the right one.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote about this in The Spectator a few months ago, very ahead of a curve. I think that the point here is the medical ethics of this are tricky. Children do not get particularly sick from COVID. It's very unusual for that to happen. And so that you would not really be vaccinating them for their own benefit, but for the benefits it would give to the general population in terms of boosting immunity across the whole of society. And I think that asking children to take on that responsibility is quite difficult. I think what is certainly true is the government cannot afford for the school year starting in September to be anywhere near as disrupted as this year has been and the last year has been.
If you look particularly today, if they're claiming we're back to normal and living it like flu.
This week, Gavin Williamson has said that, you know, exams next summer will have to be adjusted in inverted commas to take account of COVID and the disruption that's caused to education. If you got more disruption this September, this winter, then you would have to adjust, in inverted commas, the exams in 2023. And it would beg this question of when does this end? When do you manage to get education back to normal? So I think this is something the government have to be able to fix.
Thank you, James, and thank you for listening.